Welcome to Ghostly Tales of the Unexplained with your host, Simon Entwistle.
A very good evening. It's great to be back with you once again. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Simon Entwistle, and I'm a professional tour guide. I cover tours in Lancashire, Yorkshire, and Cumbria. To make these tours possible, I did need the help of local people. I find the best way to get a good ghost story is not to read about it, but to actually meet people with their experiences. I recently visited the fabulous city of Lancaster. Lancaster is the capital town of the county of Lancashire in the north of England. There is a museum there, and there's also a decommissioned prison. Part of the prison has a rather unpleasant area known simply as the courtyard, where many, many people lost their lives through, shall we say, acts of cruelty and indeed acts of defiance. I'm now going to cover two of those stories, and we're going to turn the clock back now to 1879 and a lady called Mary Holden. Mary lived in the village of Hurst Green, not too far from the town of Blackburn in Lancashire. The problem she had was a husband. He was a very, very nasty piece of work. He worked in the textile mills in Blackburn, but every night he came home, he would drink very, very heavily. And as we all know, alcohol could bring the worst out of all of us. He became very, very abusive to his wife, and Mary thought, I've got to get rid of him. I can't use a knife, I can't use a gun, but I can use poison. She made her way into nearby Blackburn, and she went to a chemist, and there she bought some strychnine. Now, strychnine in the 1870s was easily obtainable for killing rodents. She took the strychnine home, and she placed it inside the pot of tea. When her husband came home, she said, would you like a pot of tea, my dear? He was quite shocked by how friendly she was being towards him, but he gratefully accepted the tea, and he consumed it. Within a matter of minutes, he found himself on the floor, slowly dying. Much to Mary's delight, she'd got rid of him at long last. The nightmare had ended, or at least so she thought. The village police officer arrived, PC William Peckham, and Peckham said, oh yes, he's had a heart attack. We'll organise the hearse right away to get his body removed. He then made his way to the table and sat down and saw the pot of tea on the table. He also saw a most unusual white ring at the top of the teapot, and he put his finger against the white ring and smelt the residue. It was strychnine. He immediately arrested Mary, and Mary was taken to the local assizes, and there she was sent to Lancaster City Castle. She was put on trial. She mentioned how abusive her husband had been, how she'd been beaten up on many occasions, but in all fairness, she had indeed murdered her husband, and the jury found her guilty of premeditated murder. Mary very, very bravely made her way to the courtyard. She climbed the steps, and the rope was placed around her neck, and she looked around the courtyard and indeed this planet for the very last time, and then the trapdoor was pulled. Mary became the very, very last female ever to be executed in the city of Lancaster at Lancaster City Castle. However, at night time, it's a very, very spooky place, that courtyard. All the deceased prisoners were indeed buried within the castle walls. And for many, many years, prisoners who were, shall we say, sentenced at Lancaster, heard strange sounds coming from the courtyard. And many a prisoner said how he saw a female wearing a long white dress make her way along the actual area associated with the courtyard. Of course, on many, many occasions, people were hung, drawn and quartered at Lancaster. One of the biggest problems was indeed the love of the Catholic faith. Now, way back in the year 1536, King Henry VIII outlawed the Roman Catholic faith and anyone preaching Catholicism would be classed as a traitor. In Lancashire, a lot of people at that period of time were Catholics, and they refused to accept any other religion apart from Catholicism. One of them was a gentleman called Adrian Arrowsmith. His mother and father were ardent Catholics, and they sent him to France, to a place called Douai. There, he learnt to be a Catholic priest. He came back to England knowing full well that if he was caught, he would indeed face this terrible death of being hung, drawn and quartered. He made his way to the city of Preston, to a place called the Blue Boar Inn. The landlord of the Blue Boar Inn was indeed a devout Catholic. And he said, oh, don't worry, you can have the attic and they can conduct Catholic masses, which he did do. Now, he met a Protestant and a Catholic, and the Catholic said, look, will you please marry us? And Adrian Arrowsmith said, look, I will marry you, but... to live separately for at least 6 months. Well, the partner, she got very annoyed, and after 6 weeks, she really missed her husband-to-be, and she thought, that's it, I shall go to the authorities and I shall tell them all about Arrowsmith staying at the Blue Boar Inn, which she did do. Now, the local magistrate was alerted. However, the magistrate got on very well with the landlord of the Blue Boar, and he made his way to the Blue Boar and said, look, tomorrow I shall be coming here with the king's soldiers and we shall arrest this priest. It would be very, very good for you if there was no one upstairs when we arrived. So therefore, the landlord told Arrowsmith, I'm sorry, you've got to go. I've been given prior warning. The magistrates are coming tomorrow to arrest you. You have to go. So Arrowsmith made his way downstairs and climbed on his horse and was seen to gallop away from the Blue Boar Inn. However, as the magistrate was arriving, a few of his men saw the priest disappear at great speed and they gave chase. He made his way down this narrow, leafy country lane. His horse refused to jump over a ditch and he was therefore caught by the magistrate's men. They took him back to the Blue Boar Inn, they took all his money off him, and they had a good drink on Arrowsmith. He was then taken to the city of Lancaster and put on trial. He was told there and then, if you renounce your faith and become a Protestant, we will set you free. However, he refused to accept any other religion apart from the Catholic faith. He was hung, drawn and quartered on the 14th of September, 1597. However, as you can imagine, being hung, drawn and quartered is a very, very painful death. Your innards are taken out whilst you're still alive. It's a horrible death. However, in the case of Arrowsmith, he showed no emotion whatsoever. He was even seen to smile at the executioner as his intestines were being removed from his body. This had never happened before. He showed no pain whatsoever. His head was locked off, his hands were locked off, and he was quartered. However, those people watching had seen nothing like it before, and they dipped their handkerchiefs in his blood. They were quite shocked by his incredible death. His hand found itself to a place called Ashton in Makerfield, and this very, very day is in a church at Ashton in Makerfield. However, the hand is said to have healing properties. In 1972, a mother from Manchester was very, very worried about her daughter, who had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And she took him to the church, and the reverend said, look, I can bring up Father Arrowsmith's hand, and your daughter can touch the hand, and who knows, it may give some healing properties. Her daughter touched the withered hand of Adrian Arrowsmith, and within 3 weeks, she'd been completely cured of all the cancer. Now the head, or should I say the skull, also disappeared, and now lies at a place called Brewsham Hall in the Ribble Valley. Brewsham Hall is a gorgeous, gorgeous building. Now, Father Arrowsmith was canonised in 1970, and the Roman Catholic Church insisted that Bruzham Hall should let them have the head back so that it can be actually buried in consecrated ground. However, Bruzham Hall refused to let anyone have the head, and therefore it's said that a Catholic curse has been put on anyone who looks at the head. In 1991, a party took place at Bruzham Hall. As the alcohol flowed, an inquisitive guest made his way into the front reception area at Bruzham Hall, and with a hammer and a chisel, he knocked open the cabinet. The head was wrapped up inside toweling cloth. It was brought out and inspected for the first time in many years. Within 4 minutes of the head seeing light, Mrs. Parker Sr. fell to the floor as dead as a doornail. Now, she was 92 years old, but that's still no excuse. The head, to this very, very day, is still at Bruzham Hall. Let's now make our way into Yorkshire, and I conduct some amazing tours in a beautiful place called Skipton. Now, Skipton is in the Yorkshire Dales. It's the capital of the Yorkshire Dales, and it does have some amazing history. We're now going to turn the clock back in time to the 14th of May 1917, at the height of World War II. Near Skipton is an artillery range, and British soldiers are being trained there all the time to work on artillery pieces. So therefore, there's lots of soldiers in the area. A lot of them are training battalions. One such soldier was a young lad called Private John Muswick, who came from Southport near Liverpool. He was seen in the town of Skipton with a very, very beautiful young lady called Mary Gilpin. Mary was 18 years of age, and she had been seeing this young soldier for the past week. Now, they were seen to be arguing quite strongly, actually, outside a lovely old inn called the Black Horse. The following morning, poor Miss Gilpin's body was found in the river Air, not too far from the inn. It looked like she'd been strangled. Of course, it wasn't long before word spread around that she'd been seen with a soldier, and the police made their way straight to the barracks at nearby Otterburn. They got to the barracks and said, "Look, a young lady was murdered last night in Skipton. We believe that you have a Private John Muswick here." "Yes, we do," said the guard. "Well, we want to see him now. We want to arrest him to take him back to the courts in Skipton to put him on trial for murder." "Oh, it's okay, we'll deal with that," said the army. "What do you mean you'll deal with it?" said Skipton police. "He has committed a murder, a very, very serious murder. We need to take him back for trial." "Oh, don't worry, we'll deal with it," said the army. "You can't deal with it," said the police. "Oh, we can." Well, the police went back to Skipton, and you can imagine that Skipton police were absolutely furious with the army, and they got what's called a court subpoena. They went back to the barracks and were told, "Where's Muswick? We need to take him back now. We need to arrest him." "Oh, it's okay. He's been sent to France." "What do you mean he's been sent to France? He's wanted for murder." "Oh, don't worry. He won't last the day. He's in the first week of the Battle of the Somme. He won't last a day." Within 3 minutes of Private John Muswick getting to France, he'd been killed instantly. On the cenotaph at Skipton is a very, very famous name of a young boy called Jonathan Hesketh. And Jonathan, like Private John Muswick, served in World War I. He worked in the local textile mills in Skipton and had a very, very good friend at the age of 5 called Annie Cresswell. These two were very, very, very close. So unusual for 2 5-year-olds to feel so much affection, but they really, really did. By the time they were 16, they were inseparable. And by the time they were 18, they both married at All Saints Church in Skipton. On coming back from their honeymoon from the beautiful Isle of Man, John was horrified to find waiting for him his call-up papers. "Oh, I don't want to join the army. I've just got married. I don't want to join the army. I haven't even seen a German. I've got nothing against the Germans. I don't want to join the army." He had no option. He was conscripted into the York and Lancaster Regiment. He did his training and then came back to Skipton, and he had 7 days leave every second, every minute, every hour, every day of that leave meant so much to this young boy, because he knew he wasn't going to see his 19th birthday. He passionately kissed his wife for the very, very last time at Skipton Railway Station, and as the train pulled out of the station, the only thing that must have helped him was the fact that every man on that train was going through exactly the same predicament. His battalion, the York and Lancasters, got to a place called the Somme Battlefield. When they got to the Somme Battlefield, there were 90,000 other British soldiers waiting for this assault on the Somme Battlefield. They were told, "Oh, don't worry, boys, this'll be a piece of cake. We've been shelling the German lines for 3 days and three nights. There'll be no Germans left. There'll be huge gaps in the German defences. And you'll be in Berlin by Christmas." The sergeant major then said, "Oh, just very, very quickly, boys, could you all write a letter to your loved ones?" John took his haversack off and he quickly wrote a letter to young Annie in Skipton. He finished the letter and placed the letter in an envelope, and the sergeant major took each letter from each individual soldier and then withdrew his bayonet. He skewered the letters and placed the bayonet in the tip of a sandbag at the top of the trench. At exactly 7:30 on the 1st of July 1916, these men made their way over the top and advanced towards the German lines. Waiting for Johnny and the York and Lancasters was the 369th Prussian Infantry Division, highly trained German soldiers and highly dangerous German soldiers. They opened fire with devastating effect. At the end of that terrible day, 28,000 young men had been killed without seeing a single German. It was the blackest day in the history of the British Armed Forces. Somehow, back in Skipton, young Annie could feel there was something wrong. She just knew there was something wrong. She couldn't eat. She couldn't sleep. She couldn't drink. And for 7 long days, that poor girl worked around the town, just walking around the town, and all she had on her lips was the name of young Johnny. On the 8th day, the postman arrived, and the postman dropped a letter through her letterbox. As it hit the doormat, she came rushing in from the front, and she saw her name on the letter. She saw a very, very strange tear on the letter. She opened the letter, and her heart sank. The words were quite beautiful, written by young John in the trenches that morning. "Dear Annie, you are the love of my life. I worship the very ground you walk on. If I cannot come back to you in the form of a human being, I swear to you, I will come back to you in the form of a ghost and say goodbye to you in the corner of the church where we both got married at All Saints Skipton." The words were very touching. The only reason this story continued is I met Annie's granddaughter in those 7 days' leave. Her grandmother conceived, and that's how the story continued. I read the letter, and quite a few of the words had become badly smudged because, as you can imagine, Annie was deeply upset, and as the tears streamed down her cheeks, they did in fact disturb the ink. My last question to Annie's granddaughter was, "Did your grandmother make her way to the All Saints Church?" "Oh, she did. At first she couldn't see him, but she could smell him." Apparently as human beings, we all smell differently. We all have a different scent, almost like a DNA. He then made an appearance. She tried to grab him. Each time she grabbed him, her hands went straight through him. He then turned, smiled, and made his way to the next world. Poor Annie was 18 years of age, with child. She never ever remarried, and she died in 1977. All she had on her lips was the name of young Johnny, whose only crime in life was to be born at the wrong time of the last century. Let's stay in the fabulous county of Yorkshire, and we're going to make our way now to a place called the Treasurer's House, which is situated just behind the beautiful, beautiful Gothic cathedral known simply as York Minster. This is one of the most famous ghost stories you will ever, ever hear. And we shall turn the clock back now to 1952 and a chap called Harry Martindale. Harry was 18 years old in 1952 and he was a plumber's mate. He was working in the Treasurer's House, this very, very beautiful 16th century building situated behind York Minster. He was deep in the cellar. His job was to install central heating. He had a blowtorch, he had a soldering iron in one hand, and he had lots of copper piping. Of course, he used the blowpipe to heat the copper piping, to bend it, to insert it into other pipes, to install central heating. Well, it was a lovely Tuesday afternoon, October 1952. As he was working down in the cellar, he heard the sound of a trumpet, almost like a... It got louder and louder, and he thought, oh yes, students above making a nuisance. Then he looked at his watch. It's 2:30 in the afternoon. The students will all be in college by now. The trumpet got louder and louder, and out of the brick wall on the side of the cellar appeared a beautiful white horse. On that horse was a Roman soldier who looked like he was sleeping. The horse made its way through the wall with the soldier on it and out across the other side of the cellar and through the adjacent wall. He then turned and scuttled down the ladder and scuttled into the corner of the cellar and watched in amazement as Roman soldiers came out of the wall. Now, when I say Roman soldiers, these didn't look like the typical Hollywood type Roman soldier. They were emaciated. They looked really thin. They also looked extremely depressed. They had stubble, slight beards, if you will, slightly dark skin. They had what he described as a leather kilt on, a round shield, and a spear. He counted at least 8, all following in a long line, but he could only see them up to their knees. It's almost as if they didn't have any feet. As the last soldier made its way across the cellar floor, the sound of the trumpet faded. Well, as you can imagine, Harry was quite shocked. He slowly got to his feet, ran up the stairway and into the building. His boss was there. What's wrong, lad? I've just seen this Roman soldiers. Oh, come on, lad. We've got to get this job done. Get back down there and finish the job. I can't. It's haunted down there. Look, lad, if you don't go down there, I'll have to sack you. We've got a contract. We've got to get this job done. I can't. You're sacked. So poor Harry lost his job. He made his way through the centre of York down this gorgeous, gorgeous street, known simply as Stonegate. In the middle of Stonegate is a beautiful, beautiful 15th century inn called the Old Star Inn. He made his way inside the Old Star Inn, and as you can imagine, after his ghostly encounter, he needed a stiff drink. He made his way up to the bar and he ordered a double whiskey. Next to him was a young lad who glanced at him, and his words actually were, "Here, mate, you look like you've just seen a ghost." "Actually," said Harry, "I've seen about 70 ghosts this afternoon." Now, the lad he was talking to was indeed a reporter, a journalist from the York Evening Press. "Go on, lad, it sounds like a good story, this. I work for the local paper. Tell me about it. It's getting towards Halloween." Harry told him all about the ghostly Roman soldiers in the cellar. Well, the journalist thought, "I'm going to print it." The story was printed, and Harry was the butt of many a joke in the city of York. However, the joke stopped 2 weeks later because some more work had to take place deep in the cellar. They had to remove some soil to put the central heating pipes under the soil, and at the area where Harry had seen his Roman soldiers, they found a beautiful Roman floor. They removed a lot more soil, and there they found a large stone tablet with the words Eboracum. They'd found the garrison of York entry point. After all these years, they'd actually found the gatehouse, the entrance to the garrison of York. Of course, the Romans were there 2,000 years previously. And historians then had a word with Harry, and they asked him to talk about the Roman soldiers. What clothing were they wearing? And he explained that they were, it was like a kilt, a leather kilt, round shields and spears, and looked to be slightly dark skin, and also very, very emaciated, almost like starved, if you will. That's when historians put two and two together. They believe that what Harry saw that day was indeed the 9th Hispanic Legion leaving the city of York for Carlisle, and they were wiped out by the Scots, the Picts and the Celts over in the Scottish border. Also, the fact that Harry could only see them to their knees would explain why, when the soil was removed, they got to the Roman floor and the garrison to York Minster. I must say, if you've not been to York Minster, it is well worth a visit. Now, in 1967, this gorgeous Gothic cathedral started to sink. Now, York Minster is a national treasure. And, of course, the town council were horrified, and the British government were as well. They couldn't allow this national icon, which is as famous as, shall I say, St. Paul's Cathedral in London, as famous as Stonehenge, and indeed as famous as Blackpool Tower. They couldn't allow it to be destroyed. So therefore, they called in some experts, and some Swedish engineers were brought in. The Swedes are very, very good at saving buildings. They worked out that York Minster was actually sinking on its foundations, its medieval foundations from 1210. They sent some frogmen deep down into the very, very basement, because it was full of water. And as the frogmen made their way into the foundation area, they saw this gorgeous Roman underground city. They found the walls were intact. They found roads intact. They found buildings were intact. And they thought, wow, we've got to kill two birds with one stone here. We've got to save York Minster. But also, we can open up the Roman city beneath it for tourists. And that's exactly what they have done. Now, as a tour guide, I've taken many, many parties deep down to the Roman city. Actually walk down a Roman street. We go into Roman buildings. And it is very, very atmospheric. It seems that the Roman soldiers that haunted those very, very roads 2,000 years ago are still with us to this very, very day. Let's make our way across the city now to a lovely old inn called the Punchbowl Inn. Outside the Punchbowl Inn, you'll see a blue plaque saying, "Here, Richard Turpin was arrested." Who was Richard Turpin? Well, he was probably Great Britain's most famous highwayman. His real name was actually Richard Palmer, and Richard Palmer came from Essex, a county in the south of England. A chap called Ned King were very, very good at holding up stagecoaches and stealing all the wealth of their passengers. Now, they'd taken a lot of money in Essex, and as a result, the Essex authorities put a huge wager, a wanted wager, on both their heads. And they thought, well, let's come up north. Now, at that period of time in the 1730s, the city of York was nearly of Roman Britain, because you have the River Ouse that goes right into the city itself, and ideal trading links as well. So our two local Essex boys arrived in the city of York, and both of them made their way to the old Punchbowl Inn, which was run by a chap called John Briscoe. It wasn't long before these two introduced to Briscoe Essex highway robbery. And when coaches would arrive in York, of course, Turpin, as he became known, and Ned King would look and see how much wealth the ladies had, how much money the gentlemen had, and then as the coach left, they would gallop ahead to what's called the Mitten Crossroads. There, they would hold up the coaches and shout those famous words, "Stand and deliver!" Between them, they netted a small fortune. But all good things come to an end when the redcoats arrived, English infantry soldiers. In those days, in the 1730s, there was no police force, but the army had the job of maintaining law and order. A lieutenant of the King's Own Royal Rifles arrived and said, "Right, gentlemen, I want 12 musket men inside this coach. I shall pretend to be the driver. We shall make our way to the crossroads, and there we shall arrest these two. If not, we shall kill them both." They set off for the crossroads. King, and indeed Turpin, were hiding behind the hedgerow, and they shouted those famous words, "Stand and deliver!" Before the words "deliver" left their mouths, the lieutenant shouted, "Fire!" And the army volley-fired from the side of the coach. Ned King was killed instantly. Turpin tried to get on his horse, but two soldiers grabbed him, and although he gave quite a fight, he was wrestled to the ground, his hands tied behind his back, and he was frog marched back into the city of York. There he was thrown into the prison, into what's called the condemned cell. Now this right up to York, and the mayor of York thought, "I need to make a spectacle of him. Let's have a real execution." So a huge gallows were built at what we now call the racecourse in York. And in 1739, Dick Turpin was taken from the cell, and there he made his way to the gallows. As he looked around him, a huge crowd came to gather, and local mayors and local dignitaries all had front seats to watch the execution. However, Turpin thought, "I shan't give this lot the satisfaction." He had the rope placed round his neck, his hands tied behind his back, and he had to walk up to the very, very top by a ladder to the very, very top of the scaffold. However, halfway at the scaffold, he jumped, and his neck was broken cleanly and efficiently. He ruined everyone's day because he spoilt the very, very, very end. A most amazing story from the city of York. On my tours in York, we visited a place called Bedden, which has changed an awful lot. Bedden, in that period of time, the 1740s, 50s and 60s, was a slum area of the city of York. Now, a gentleman of the name Mr. Francis Pym, he looked after the workhouse at Bedden. And in the workhouse, he had lots of children. They were all orphans. And he was given an allowance of York City Council to make sure these children all had at least one meal a day. However, what Pims was doing, he was indeed pocketing all the money himself, so the children were literally starving and had to scavenge off the streets of York. Of course, they had to be back in the orphanage by a certain time, otherwise they were flogged, and flogged severely by Pims himself. Because of malnutrition, a lot of them were dying. And what he did with the bodies, he would lift the skirting boards and put the bodies under the skirting board. As you can imagine, the aroma wasn't very, very pleasant. However, he still continued to receive the money off the local council. His little game was about to be revealed when a council official came to see him one day. And he was very, very shocked at the horrific stench that was coming from under the floorboards, but also he could only count 15 children when there should have been at least 80. That's when the floorboards were lifted and the aroma filled the whole of the orphanage. There, beneath the floorboards, were the remains of at least 125 individual children who had all been starved to death by Pims. He was then taken to the prison, and just like our friend Richard Turpin, the famous highwayman, he was put on trial. He had no alibi whatsoever and was executed again in front of a huge crowd in 1773. A most amazing character. But the city of York is absolutely full of stories, and some new stories emerge every day. Only 3 years ago, an internet line was being laid very, very near the museum, and a trench was dug. And as the engineers were digging the trench, they came across the foot of an adult skeleton. They, of course, had to suspend what they were doing, and the York City archaeological students made their way down to the museum, and they removed a lot of soil. They came across a huge, huge skeleton. The skeleton must have been 7 feet tall. Next to the first skeleton, they found another one, also around 7 feet tall. Huge, huge skeleton. They found in all 5 skeletons, all around 7 feet tall. They were quite surprised. And the head was placed in between their legs. Of course, now with modern forensic science, the scientists came along and they took samples from each of the teeth of these huge men and found that they all came from North Africa. And examinations took place of the skeletons, and they found on the scapula, on the clavicles, on the fib and tibs, some very, very unusual marks. And one very, very bright scientist said, "I've got it. I've got it. These men were gladiators. They were all from North Africa. They were chosen because of their huge height and huge physiques, sent to York for entertainment purposes. The marks on their bones correspond with marks of bite marks from lions, tigers, and indeed bears. And these poor lads had literally had to fight their lives in the entertainment areas for the York garrison 2,000 years ago. They were absolutely huge. This very day, you can see the skeletons, and that's at what's called the Jorvik Centre. In the city, a place called Coppergate in York, and all these 5 skeletons are on display, and you can clearly see the bite marks. They must have been very, very brave lads, but also very, very tough lads. So let's now leave the city of York, and we shall make our way to the rather beautiful town of Cone, and a place called Cone Hall. Now, Cone is in Lancashire. The town of Cone was indeed a very, very busy textile town. Lancashire and Yorkshire, very, very famous for world textiles. In fact, the textile workers used to boast, "Let's clothe Great Britain before breakfast and the rest of the world afterwards." Now, the textile barons were not very nice people. All they cared about was making money. And of course, time was money. In the town of Cone was a very, very large textile factory run by the Shaw family. And John Shaw didn't care about how many people he lost. He just wanted production. Now, he had lots of young orphans working for him. The reason children were employed in the factory, as well, in his case, not actually paid, he would just feed them, if you will. He needed children to crawl under what's called the looms. Now, what's a loom? Well, a loom is indeed a weaving machine. It has many, many moving parts. And, of course, it would go backwards and forwards, literally weaving cloth all day long. Sometimes you get what's called spent cotton that would fall to the floor, and this could be reused, but you couldn't stop production, but you would send a child, and that child would have to crawl on hands and knees or elbows and knees right under the rotating equipment and bring out the spent cotton. On the 14th of August, 1851, a young girl called Hannah Corbridge, she was only 6 years old, against her will, against her wishes, she was forced to crawl under rotating equipment. She had long golden hair. Terribly, tragically, her hair was caught in the rotating equipment, and the poor girl was literally strangled to death. Shaw was concerned not about the death of this poor young girl, but concerned about loss of production. He had the girl's hair cut from the loom, her body tossed into a sack, and production started straight away. However, this young girl, Hannah, her ghost still haunts the area, and she's been seen by quite a few people. Now, Cone police have had a particular problem with her, because she's seen to actually haunt the Shaw residence. The Shaw family had a beautiful, beautiful hall, which is now privately owned by, of all people, the National Trust, would you believe? And that is situated in Cone town centre. Hannah's ghost has been seen on the steps. It seems that she's determined to always make her presence known. She's seen to skip with a skipping rope on the steps of Cone Hall. The most famous sighting took place in 1957 when a police officer was patrolling the town, and as he made his way down through Cone town centre with his torch, he could hear the sound of tapping. He turned round and looked at Cone Hall in the high street and saw what looked like a young lady just skipping on the steps. He approached her. She looked up towards him and literally vaporised. The police constable was deeply shocked, and he immediately lit a cigarette and rushed back to the police station, where his colleagues laughed at him. However, one man did not laugh, and that was indeed the desk sergeant, the duty sergeant. "Look, I believe you, lad. I believe you. I've been a bobby in Cone for some 30 years, and I too have seen the ghost of Hannah Corbridge. She's been destined to haunt the Shaw residence in retribution for her murder all those years ago." And let's be honest, it was indeed murder. Let's now make our way into the beautiful, beautiful market town of Clitheroe. I've been conducting tours in Clitheroe now for, since 1996. And a story has just come to light. British public houses, as you've gathered, all have great stories behind them. And the White Lion is one of the oldest public houses in the town of Clitheroe, actually built in 1758. Upstairs, you'll find an attic. And in that attic is the perfectly preserved pine cockpit, wooden pine cockpit. What's a cockpit? Well, these public houses in cities and towns had illegal cock fighting, where you would take a cockerel upstairs, you would place in its feet a metal sheath like a razor blade. You'd then throw the cockerel into the pit and watch the cockerels fight to the very, very death. Totally illegal, very, very cruel, but most public houses had illegal cockfighting. In 1824, a young lady of the name of Janet Chamley would visit the White Lion. In those days, there was not such a thing as a licensing law, so anyone could drink alcohol. And you could get a small glass of gin for threepence. Janet, through no fault of her own, looked like a typical fairy tale witch. She was blind in one eye. She was short in one leg. She had facial warts on her face. And she was not a pleasant sight to look at. She also had terrible, terrible body odours. She made her way into the White Lion, as she had on many occasions, but she'd also really upset the landlord. And the landlord got quite annoyed and said, "Look, don't come back in here again. You're not welcome." He was called William Hamer, and Hamer said, "Look, don't come in here again. You're banned, lass." She made her way out of the building, but was desperate for another drink, and came in through the back door, hoping that she could get to the bar without being noticed, but was met by a farmer of the name of Tom Halliday. And Halliday said, "Look, you're being told not to come in here, lass. Get out. You're not welcome." The following morning, William Hamer was horrified to find his wife dead, upstairs in bed, without a mark in her body. She was only 41 years old. When Halliday got back to his farm, he was a farmer in the village of Waddington, he was horrified to find all his Frisian cattle were dead. All his hens were dead. Both Halliday and Hamer blamed Janet Chamley. They were convinced that she was a witch. In the early hours of the morning, she was, shall we say, enticed to make her way upstairs to the cockpit in the attic. She was quite surprised by this kindness and was even given a large measure of gin, which she gratefully accepted. She made her way upstairs. There, she was met by Hamer and Halliday. They threw a rope over the beam. She tried to make her getaway, but the rope was placed around her neck, and Janet was lifted from her feet and was literally hung to death. They released the pressure, and they rolled her body in a carpet. They carried her body in the dead of night down the twisting staircase of the White Lion, and there she was placed in a waiting horse and trap. They galloped at great speed into the night, up to a place called Waddington Fell, a very, very quiet, remote moorland. There, Hamer and Halliday started to dig a very deep grave for her. They placed Janet's body in the carpet at the bottom of the grave and filled in the grave. They got back into Clitheroe just as the sun was rising and made their way inside the White Lion to have a celebration drink. Their job had been done. Of course, the Chamley family were quite surprised. "Where's our Janet? We've not seen her for 2 days. Where is she?" She just literally disappeared. Of course, no one had any idea that she had indeed been murdered. The story came to light 36 years later, when Hamer was on his deathbed. And he thought, "There's no way I can enter the gates of heaven unless I confess my sins here on earth." And he called for the local Roman Catholic priest. The priest arrived and he told him all about the murder of Janet Chamley 36 years previously. Of course, the priest felt obliged to contact the Chamleys to tell them what had happened to their daughter. And by the time the authorities came to arrest Hamer, he had died, and you can't hang a dead man. However, Janet's ghost still haunts the cockpit of the White Lion. Her ghost is only seen and heard around the Christmas period. The landlord, Peter and Claire of the White Lion, will close the public house down for Christmas Day and Boxing Day. That's when they both heard the sounds of footsteps and laughing and giggling coming from the stairwells, when they know that there's only two people in the building, themselves. But I must say, the inn is definitely, definitely worth a visit. Let's now make our way to the coastline. And Lancashire, of course, had a very, very large fishing port called Fleetwood. And Fleetwood was indeed one of the main fishing ports in Great Britain. The Fleetwood fishermen would make their way into the Irish Sea and then right up to the North Atlantic and right up to Iceland. And there they would bring back huge catches of cod, all for the British markets. The Icelandic government weren't too fond of this, actually, and after at least 60 years, they stopped British vessels from actually fishing there. However, we're now going to turn the clock back in time now to 1947 and the story of the Goth. The Goth was indeed a Fleetwood trawler. It had a crew of some 18 men. And in December 1947, the Goth crew gathered at Fleetwood and they told their wives, their mothers, their girlfriends, "Oh, don't worry, we'll be back for Christmas, no problem at all. We're going to go out to Iceland and have a right good catch." The Goth set out. With the Fleetwood fishing crews came the crews from Hull in Yorkshire. And towards the 19th of December of that year, a huge storm erupted. Huge troughs of water, and the fishing fleet found itself scattered. Now, the skipper of the Goth got onto his radio and gave out a distress. This was picked up by a Hull trawler called the Lincoln Castle. And the skipper of the Lincoln Castle said, "Look, my advice for you is to go into Iceland, into Reykjavik, and that way you'll be away from the storm." However, the Goth never made it. And her crew and the Goth were never ever seen again. You can imagine, back in Fleetwood, mothers, sisters, brothers, loved ones were deeply shocked at the loss of the entire crew of the Goth. Some 53 years later, a most amazing find took place. An Icelandic trawler was fishing off the coast of Iceland, and as the nets came up, up came the funnel of the Goth with her Fleetwood pennant number. The actual funnel had been in such deep, deep water that rust had not occurred because there's no oxygen down there. And the actual chimney is now on display in the town of Fleetwood as a reminder of the terrible, terrible tragedies that took place from there. However, there's also been stories of a ghostly fishing vessel that has been seen only on stormy nights off the Icelandic coast. Many people believe it is indeed the ghost ship known simply as the Goth, but her funnel is certainly with us in the Fleetwood town in Lancashire, known simply as the Fisherman's Wharf. We're now going to make our way from Fleetwood, and we shall make our way into the town of Kendal, and we shall visit another public house. A pub that has a most unusual name, the Angel. Now, we are going to turn the clock back to 1745. At that period of time, a gentleman called Bonnie Prince Charlie, he was a Catholic, a Stuart, and he arrived in the Outer Hebrides at a very, very beautiful island called Eriksey. He had come from France and he was on a mission, and that mission was to put a Catholic on the throne of England once again. Of course, up in Scotland, the Scottish Highlanders, they welcomed him and they were very, very proud to see a Stuart amongst them. They formed this huge army from Scotland and they advanced towards England. Now, quite surprisingly, in Lancashire and Yorkshire, there were lots of Catholic sympathisers, Englishmen that believed also in Catholicism, and they joined the famous Jacobite Rebellion. The prince led his forces towards the city of Carlisle on the English-Scottish border, took the city of Carlisle and made their way down towards Penrith and then into the town of Kendal, where Bonnie Prince Charlie proclaimed himself King of England. They set off through Kendal and were met by the mayor of Kendal, a very brave man called Mr. John Firth, who said, "Look, take all the food, take all our cattle, take all our snuff and all our alcohol, but please leave the women and girls alone." And the prince agreed to this. and they set off, taking as much as they wanted but leaving the females alone. The prince and his army, they got to the city of Derby in the Midlands. In the city of London, this absolute panic and pandemonium taking place, because everyone expects this huge Scottish army to arrive and take the whole of the city of London. The French army are just waiting to invade. All they need is the word from the prince, and they will join him in the south of England. However, they stopped at Derby. A fatal mistake. Had they carried on, they would have taken England, and yes, the England would once again have become a Catholic nation. However, they stopped, and they about turned and made the long journey back up north. When these stragglers of the prince's army arrived in Kendal, they were in no mood for clemency at all. But one thing John Firth had done, the mayor of Kendal this time, is he knew the rabble were coming back, and he told all the women, all the girls, to leave the town as soon as possible, and they made their way to the hills surrounding the town of Kendal. When the Jacobites arrived in Kendal, they made their way to the high street. They were ransacking homes, they were setting fire to homes, they were taking alcohol, food, anything they could get their hands on. And all of a sudden, they stopped, and quite a few of the Highlanders actually knelt down as if in prayer, because left in one of the houses in the centre of Kendal was a little girl called Jean Caradus. Jean was 6 years old. She had very, very long, beautiful straw-coloured blonde hair. She was wearing a nightdress. Her mother and father had somehow lost her when they ran up to the hills. They had left their daughter behind, thinking that she'd gone ahead of them. She made her way to the front of the building, and as the Jacobites, the Scottish Highlanders, made their way into the town, they immediately gave her a wide berth, and some stopped to pray, because they were convinced she was indeed an angel. And the Jacobites immediately turned to the left, leaving the town centre and bypassing the town of Kendal, so they didn't have to confront the angel. Of course, this very, very day, if you make your way to the beautiful market town of Kendal, known simply as Angel Inn, the Angel of Kendal. As the Jacobites, well, they never ever did take London, and certainly and the English redcoats forced him all the way up to Culloden, where this bloodbath took place. And to this very, very day, the Scots will call a plant known as Sweet William Stinking Willie, after the Duke of Cumberland. Of course, this is all history, but Scotland is now, of course, who knows, perhaps next time I might have some stories from the beautiful, beautiful Scottish city of Edinburgh. Well, I really, really hope you've enjoyed tonight's show. There's many, many stories to come, of course. If you would like to go to my website, it's simply www.tophattours.co.uk. I also have lots of stories on YouTube under Simon Entwistle, Tales from the Grave. And we have lots of stories, some, of course, of which you've seen today. So, I'd like to bid you a very good night. And until the last time, this is Simon Entwistle wishing you a very ghostly tales of the unexpected. Thank you.